On October 16, 1999, a woman called 911. According to the dispatcher, the caller was crying, screaming, pleading for her life. The woman said she'd been tied up and raped and had struggled to the phone, dialing with her tongue. The caller was afraid her assailant would return. She did not say she'd been smoking crack or losing consciousness. Units were subsequently dispatched to the location. Reporter's transcript 2, 1208 to 1215. One of the Compton patrol officers who responded to the radio call heard a woman crying inside the home. She unlocked the door with her feet, and the police entered the house. The woman was laying on the living room floor wearing only a white blouse, her knees and ankles bound with tightly knotted bed sheets. Her elbows and wrists were bound behind her back. Her mouth was gagged with a piece of bed sheet and bound with duct tape wrapped around the back of her head. She was crying. Reporter's transcript 2, 1217 to 1224, 2, 1227. 7 to 1231. The officer untied the woman, cutting the duct tape out of her hair. Reporter's transcript 2, 1225. There were cut up bed sheets and a pair of scissors on the floor next to the woman. Police recovered crack cocaine pipes, a hypodermic needle, an empty Ziploc baggie with cocaine residue, and an unwrapped condom from the bedroom next to the living room. The condom was on top of the bed. The other items were on top of the dresser. Reporter's transcript 2, 1233 to 1237, 2, 1244 to 1245, 2, 1247, 2, 1249. The preliminary hearing testimony of Virginia was read. Virginia testified that 11:30 p.m. on October 15, 1999, she was at home when her manager came in and told her there was some business outside. Virginia provides sex for money. She went outside. The manager indicated a red Nissan. Appellant was driving. Virginia got in the car, and they drove to appellant's house, agreeing on a price of $50, half of the money before, half after. There was no mention of bondage sex. Reporter's transcript 2, 1270 to 1274, 2, 1281 to 1283. Once inside, they went into appellant's bedroom. He gave her $25, and they sat for a while watching TV, doing cocaine, and drinking small bottles of wine. Appellant orally copulated Virginia, then told her he had to leave and get some crack. She waited for him, drinking and dozing off. When she awoke, appellant was squatting over her. She was bound, her hands taped together in front of her, her legs spread apart and taped to the bottom bedboard. She was wearing her bra, but her pants and panties had been removed. She had not agreed to be tied up. Virginia asked appellant what he was doing. He said, "You're fixing to get raped." Virginia dozed off twice before appellant left. He asked her if she was tired. She told him she was sick. Reporter's transcript 2, 1274 to 1276, 2, 1284 to 1288. Virginia taped appellant's mouth. He would get up periodically, seemingly nervous, taking hits of cocaine. He digitally penetrated her three times and felt her. He removed the tape so Virginia could orally copulate him. He orally copulated her. He was very rough, pulling her hair. At one point, Virginia said that he didn't have to do this, that all he had to do was ask her, even if he didn't have money to pay. Appellant said he didn't care. He told her to ask Keisha. She's done it before. Reporter's transcript 2, 1277 to 1280, 2, 1289 to 1290, 2, 1295 to 1298. After he was finished, appellant left, telling Virginia not to try to get away. She got one hand free and rolled and scooted to the phone, dialing 911 with her tongue. Virginia had never met appellant before that night. She didn't notice anything unusual about appellant's penis or scrotum. Reporter's transcript 2, 1280 to 1284, 2, 1291 to 1295, 2, 1298. Virginia was starting to withdraw from heroin that night and was nodding, dozing on and off throughout the incident. She had three 12-ounce bottles of Cisco before falling asleep. Reporter's transcript 2, 1285, 2, 1287 to 1288. It was stipulated that Virginia testified at appellant's preliminary hearing on February 8, 1999, sometime after 1:30 p.m. Virginia was pronounced dead on February 9, 1999 at 6:45 a.m. Reporter's transcript 2, 1299 to 1300. Evidence Code Section 1108, WNS. On May 12, 1995, W lived a block away from appellant in Nickerson Gardens. She was then freebasing cocaine. That evening, W was at home with her children when appellant came by to get his cocaine pipe. Appellant asked W if she wanted to go to his house to get high. She said she did and later walked to appellant's house. Reporter's transcript 3, 1502 to 1505. Once inside, W went to the bathroom. The lights went off. When they came back on, appellant had a knife at W's throat. He told her to undress. She refused. After some back and forth, appellant threatened to do it to W's 13-year-old daughter, S. W agreed to undress, and appellant threw her onto a mattress in the bedroom. He tied W's hands behind her back, tied her legs and ankles, and gagged and taped her mouth. Appellant orally copulated W, had her orally copulate him, then vaginally penetrated her. He asked W how she would like him to do that to her daughter. She said to leave her daughter alone. Reporter's transcript 3-1504 to 1508, 3-1512. Appellant called W, told W to call S and tell her to bring W some money. He said he would kill her if she didn't get S to come. When S arrived at 11 p.m., appellant pulled her inside. W heard S screaming, "Mommy, Mommy." Appellant put a knife to S's throat and told her to undress. He threw S naked onto the mattress next to W, who was still bound. W watched appellant rape her daughter. Appellant next took W and S into another room, saying he would kill them if they didn't cooperate. He went back and forth between W and S the rest of the night. He also vaginally penetrated W in front of S. As he touched S, S turned her back. At some point, appellant put a vibrator in S's vagina. He had her orally copulate him. S had never had sex before that night and told appellant that it hurt. Reporter's transcript 3-1509 to 1511, 3-1515 to 1519. Defense case. Dr. George Dubin is a surgeon psychiatrist who has treated drug alcohol addicts. He reviewed Virginia's autopsy report, which indicated that the cause of death was a multiple drug overdose in interaction with methamphetamines, cocaine, heroin, and morphine. Given Virginia was pronounced dead at 6:45 a.m. on February 9, 1999, her death came within 15 to 16 hours after her preliminary hearing testimony. According to Dubin, Virginia was a chronic drug user, specifically of heroin. The heroin metabolite stays in the system for about 7 hours. If someone was nodding off, that would indicate they were under the influence. Someone under the influence can answer questions in a responsive manner. If someone is in a blackout, they could do things they would not recall once sober. They might agree to do something and not recall the agreement once sober. Drug combinations can exacerbate blackouts. Reporter's transcript 3-1540 to 1546, 3-1548, 3-1553 to 1554. If someone ingested three bottles of 18% malt liquor and was using cocaine and heroin during a short period of time and said they had a blackout, that would seem honest. Reporter's transcript 3-1546 to 1547. Appellant testified that he had committed the offenses against W and her daughter and felt terrible about it. He pled no contest to a 20-year sentence because he knew he was guilty. He did not plead guilty in the present case because he is not guilty. Reporter's transcript 3-1803, 3-1823 to 1824, 3-1839 to 1840. The first time appellant saw Virginia was outside a Mexican market when she wiped his windows for money. The next time she was babysitting for a friend. A week or two later, appellant told his friend that he wanted to see Virginia. They went to Akeisha's apartment where appellant picked up Virginia. Reporter's transcript 3-1803 to 1806. Appellant and Virginia agreed on a fee of $25 for bondage sex. In 1998, one could get a prostitute in Compton for a $5 hit of rock cocaine. The extra money offered here was because appellant wanted something special. They stopped en route at a market, and appellant brought Virginia a large bottle of Peach Cisco and a pack of Salems. Once at appellant's house, they smoked some cocaine. Virginia drank Cisco, then got sick, kept passing out. Appellant asked if she was okay. She said she needed her heroin outfit. Appellant took her back to her van. She got her needle and drugs and returned to appellant's home where she injected herself. Reporter's transcript 3-1806 to 1809, 3-1816, 3-1819 to 1821, 3-1827 to 1828, 3-1832 to 1833, 3-1838 to 1839. At some point, appellant left to find more heroin for Virginia because she kept nodding off. Reporter's transcript 3-1811 to 1834. 3-1828 to 1832, 3-1833 to 1838. Appellant did not orally copulate Virginia. She did not orally copulate him. Appellant was frightened of HIV. They ended up not doing anything because Virginia kept getting sick and needing more drugs. Reporter's transcript 3-1809 to 1811, 3-1815 to 1817, 3-1823, 3-1827. Appellant did not threaten to rape Virginia. There was no need, as he'd already paid her for sex. He never hit her. He couldn't have sat on top of her as she orally copulated him because he had a waterbed and weighed about 200 pounds at the time. Reporter's transcript 3-1811 to 1812, 3-1841 to 1842. If appellant referred to W as a bitch, it was not personal. To appellant, every woman is a bitch. Reporter's transcript 3-1825 to 1826. Statement of facts. Jhansi, counts 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 21. Jhansi was 17 years old at the time of trial. For the past 6 years, she's told the police she was 5 years older because she is a prostitute and didn't want them to know she was a minor. At trial, Jhansi testified that she did not remember or did not want to answer a number of questions. When Jhansi was asked to testify at appellant's preliminary hearing, she laid on the floor and refused to leave because she had nothing to say. After police put restraints and shackles on Jhansi, she screamed and kicked, saying she did not want to go, reports transcript 4, 686 to 687. Jhansi did testify that she told Detective Haidt that in November 1998, when Jhansi was 11, she met appellant at a Greyhound bus station in San Bernardino and he took her to Los Angeles. She testified she did not tell appellant she was 11 at the time and said she did not remember whether she told the detective she told appellant her age or if appellant told her that she was pretty and would take her on a date or if he gave her his telephone number if she agreed to date appellant. Jhansi testified she never told appellant her age, reporters transcript 4, 684 to 696. 4, 693, 4, 708 to 709. Jhansi did not remember telling the detective she called appellant and met him at an auto body shop that he showed her photographs of girls in short shorts and stilettos, or whether he asked her if she wanted to look like the girls in the photos. She did not remember telling the detective that appellant said she would look like the girls if she stayed with him, that he would buy her pretty clothes, or that she told appellant her parents didn't care about her, so she should go with him. Jhansi testified she went with appellant of her own free will, and he did not force her to do anything. Reporters transcript 4690 to 692, 4694, 4709 to 710. Jhansi did not remember if she went to a motel with appellant or whether appellant told her he was a pimp and the woman in the pictures were his whores. Jhansi testified she did not know appellant was a pimp. She did not remember appellant asking if she would whore for him or promising her pretty clothes or saying her parents didn't care for her or letting her call them and when there was no answer saying that if they were worried they would have been there or that she then agreed to work for him. She did not remember telling the detective appellant said never take less than $50 for head, explained head meant oral sex, or that the customer should touch her breast, or she should fondle the customer's penis to make sure the person was not a police officer, or that if she was going to a hotel with a customer, she should first call appellant or bring the money to appellant right after sex, or that if she did all this, she would be rewarded with pretty clothes and appellant would take care of her. Reporter's transcript 4692 to 695. Jhansi testified that she did not remember telling the detective appellant then took her shopping for new clothes and had her hair and nails done, or that later two black men arrived. Appellant told Jhansi to just do what they say. One of the men took out his penis and said, just do it, suck my dick. She did not recall saying that she left that night to try to get away, but appellant found her and brought her back to the motel where she and appellant took showers, and appellant asked if Jhansi had ever had sex, and she said no, and that she didn't know anything about sex, reporter's transcript 4695 to 697. Jhansi did not remember telling the detective appellant laid on the bed, took out a condom, explained to Jhansi how to put it on his erect penis, and repeatedly demanded Jhansi orally copulate him until she complied. Then a short time later told Jhansi to lay face up and put his penis in her vagina, or that she demanded he stop because she was in pain, but that he did not stop until he decided to do so. She did not remember telling the detective that the next morning appellant introduced her to his other prostitutes, or that in the evening appellant took her to a house party in South Los Angeles, reporter's transcript 4697 to 699. Jhansi did not recall telling the detective that at the party, another one of appellant's prostitutes, a woman named Cinnamon, told Jhansi to stay with her, that she would show Jhansi how it's done. Or that Cinnamon was approached by a man at the party. She told Jhansi to follow them into the backyard, where Cinnamon orally copulated, the man was paid, and then told Jhansi, that's how it's done. Later at the party, another man approached Jhansi. They had sex. Jhansi felt bad afterwards, but felt better after being paid. Jhansi did not recall telling the detective she told Cinnamon she got paid. Cinnamon told her to give the money to Macbone. She told Cinnamon she wasn't going to. Cinnamon told appellant Jhansi was refusing to pay him. Appellant took the money from Jhansi's bra. Jhansi told appellant it was her money. She earned it. And appellant said, bitch, it's my money. All your money is my money. She did not remember telling the detective appellant slapped her repeatedly or that she dropped to the floor so as not to get hurt, or that appellant slapped and choked her and said not to get him mad, did she want him to go to jail, or that they returned to the motel, or that the next day appellant asked Jhansi if she was mad at him because he had hit her, and to stop her from being angry, took her to Disneyland. Reporter's transcript 4699 to 702. She did not recall telling the detective that a few days later, appellant drove her to Figueroa to start street walking, telling her to touch customers in the groin to make sure they weren't law enforcement, and if they refused to be touched, to get out of the car, or to look at the license plate to see if it was an undercover police car, or never to get in the car with a black man or girls because they would try to recruit her to work for another pimp, or never to make eye contact with a police officer, she could then be stopped, or saying that for the rest of the day she performed various acts of prostitution and gave all the money to appellant, or that she worked 7 days a week, sometimes earning up to $1,500 a day, or that appellant took her and other prostitutes to Arizona, Washington, D.C., New York, Nevada, and Florida to work, taking her to Pico and Alvarado beforehand to get a false identification card for flying, reports transcript 4702-704. Johnsey did not recall telling police she was working for appellant when she was arrested on February 26, 2002, June 26, 2002, April 19, 2003, October 9, 2003, April 10, 2004, or June 18, 2004. Johnsey has been arrested a lot for prostitution. Johnsey testified she's been a prostitute since she was 11, has worked everywhere, never worked for a pimp, did not give money to appellant, lived everywhere, and stayed in group homes since she was 13. She always runs away from the homes to go back to work. Johnsey pays her own way and likes her life. Reporter's transcript 4702-703, 4729-735. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question about kind of the amount of intent that you have. It's mainly towards how much do you know you're putting across as opposed to how much you want to put across?
I have no intent.
No intent?
No intent.
Did you study poetry?
Yes. I've been, yeah.
Do you know what you're doing there? Do you know what effects that you maybe have on people?
My goal is, let me tell a story. Here's my story. When I do the statement of facts pieces, people have various reactions. One reaction, I did a performance in London last July, and a woman began sobbing and left the theater and had to be extracted from the bathroom about an hour later. And afterwards she confronted me and asked, how do you feel about doing that to me? And I said, I did nothing to you. You had a reaction to a piece of language, to a piece of text, a very powerful reaction that was entirely your own. So that was in you. What happened was you encountered material that brought that out. Said, on the other hand, how great. When's the last time you went to a poetry reading and actually felt something? So my point is that poetry, I think, and if I could say this, fundamental mission, the idea of it was that it evoked some sort of response. I'm interested in creating a situation that evokes a response. What that response is not my business. It's none of my business.
There was a lot of what both of you talked about around the idea of guilt. First of all, we need to problematize that. There are two senses of guilt, the de jure guilt and an effective guilt. And there was one interrupt that you just said just now, and you said you have no intent in what you say. Are you guilty of what you say?
I'm guilty of reiterating it. I'm guilty of reiterating it, and I'm guilty of not providing a context for it. I think that in some ways, the work's been called unethical, and in some ways I do think that the most unethical thing that I do is, if it can be looked at that way, is I don't provide a context for the material or a way, I don't signal my intent.
Why is that unethical?
Because I think that what people are used to in the world at large, I'm not saying it's unethical, I'm just saying that this is what I suspect is the actual point, the actual locus of people's discomfort, is that I don't provide a mediating context for them to receive the material.
I mean, that seems to be sort of what's
That's the argument. But I think that for the people that have difficulty with this material, when it comes down to it, the material is quite quotidian and people encounter it all the time. They just encounter it in a mediated form. So I think that's actually the point where it becomes interesting, is to take away the mediation.
Could you explain a bit? I'd be interested to see why you thought that, where you said that that's what makes it ethical. Could you explain that a little bit? Not to put you on the spot, but I'm interested in.
Well, in the sense that, okay, if we can distinguish between morality as something that is inscribed and socially accepted and conventional, and ethical as a unique response to that, which is a responsibility in responding to that. I think what Vanessa does is put each of us in a position where we have to respond. She's not telling us how we should respond. There's no prescription in what she's reading, what she's writing. And that puts us in a position where we're forced to take responsibility, where there is, in a sense, no way out. And even getting out and running to the bathroom for an hour is not a way out. We have to respond in some way, even if we ignore it. And in that sense, it seems to be very good.
I think the way that you're kind of talking about it sounds, you know, this idea, it sounds very much like a mirror or something. And you know, this idea of a mirror is used a lot in conceptual art as a practice. You know, I think what's, you know, other people in the room would know better than me, but like artists like Dan Graham or somebody using an idea to reflect back to the audience their own consequences or something. I maybe something that's interesting in this situation is that it's Vanessa's taking the difficult decision to root that kind of reflecting back in matters of, you know, life and death and violence and things that not just the material consequences of the room or something, but something much more than that. And I find that quite rare in a conceptual approach, perhaps. That's maybe a passing comment. Does anybody have any other questions or statement?
Would it be able to play a piece of poetry as a comment to the content? Would that be possible for him? No?
I couldn't hear the middle bit of what you said. Could you say it again? Sorry.
Would there be possible to play a piece of music from an MP3 player as a comment to the content?
Can if maybe not straight away, but maybe if you wanted to go up to the box, I think that's possibly.
Yeah, okay. It was more like because I found myself not necessarily speechless, but it evoked a reaction, but I didn't go into the bathroom, I just turned on my iPod as soon as I went out.
Or you could play it through this microphone here if you...
No, I don't have. I don't think.
If you go outside, somebody will show you how to get up to the box, and Kenny can help you put it through the PA if you're interested. How long is it? Is it like 40 minutes long?
No, it's one conventional song.
Okay, yeah, that would be very interesting. Maybe we could have another question whilst you work that out, and then give me a wave when you're ready to do it. That guy can take you up. There's a question here.
Please, a question. And first of all, thank you very much. I thought it was fantastic. You always perform the words.
Perform the statement of facts?
Pardon?
Perform the statement of facts?
Yeah.
Well, it does exist as a book.
But does it, yeah. Because I think one of the extraordinary things for me, of course, is the fact you were performing it. And, you know, that's about choice, and it's about what you've chosen for us to listen to and us to see you perform. In the way that any other, it's not the same as any other piece of theatre would be, for example. I thought it was fantastic on that level. I just wondered if it would work. I mean, I don't know if it would work as just reading it. I'm going to read it. Would you want to read it? Would you want to play with it? And also the way that you performed it. And that's just why I asked it, the way to perform it, I think.
It works very differently on the page.
Go.
It is a form of mediation in a sense, and certainly for me, getting back to the poetry issue, for a moment, part of, when you look at it on the page, it doesn't look like what poetry looks like. It's not, And I literalize all the apparatus of the book. So quite literally, there's no one justification. There's no right justification or left justification. It's just a big block of text. But when I perform it, I'm sort of upping the ontological status of it as poetry by reading it in a sort of poetic fashion. So for me, that becomes interesting as well. And by the same token, the material is so what it is that there's a sort of contrapuntal note in performing it differently than you might encounter if you encountered it just pure on the page.
Yeah, I mean, just because it is really easy, because the dropping of the pages, you know, the way you sway it, the small bits of performance are very, very potent and make it, you know, a fantastic piece of performance. So, thank you.
You said that, you said this about being in context that you give this presentation, but obviously there's context because you're in a shopping mall or here and where you're at it. And some of us have researched you and some of us don't know who you are, but so I would decry that the idea of that there is a context. And the other thing that occurred to me, you said it was really interesting to get that kind of passionate response to poetry. And I was thinking as I was listening to you that it had a kind of visceral response to me and probably to everybody in a way that I've had at rock concerts, for instance. So I was thinking how, you know, there's maybe an overlap between, I mean, I'm talking very abstractly now, between your poetry reading and maybe going to a rock concert.
Well, I think the context is, if I can respond just to the context idea, two things. One is the context is this context. This context is unique to this. It's site-specific, right? That's one point. The other point is that the context in which you're encountering it has absolutely nothing to do with the functional context that it was generated in. And in that way, it's different than the rock show, because they wrote songs, presumably, or generated material to perform at a rock show. This material was generated to present in a brief to a court of appeal. So the context doesn't mirror point of origin, which is why there's a slight pun there on the con in the text. You know, because I am insufferable in that way.
Yeah.
I thought I really liked it. You said something about provoking a reaction in an audience or readership as a sort of, well, was that as an ethical act to, you know, force someone to engage ethically with, well, engage ethically in whatever way that is? Is that,
you tell me.
Well, that's maybe what I think is going on in part. And then, when you were talking about poetry as getting a reaction from people, I just thought about meditation practice and everything I've read about meditation, and, you know, people are constantly having reactions, at least as I understand it and practice it, that one of the purposes of meditation is to become more aware of our reactions, to give ourselves more freedom, you know, to be aware of what's going on in our, you know, mind, body, so that, you know, we can make different choices or have more freedom because we're more aware of our ingrained reactions and so on. I wondered if for me, ethics could perhaps be more, or should perhaps be more about, awareness of the process of reaction rather than just reaction. And if, like, I don't know, prompting a reaction was enough, because, you know, people have reactions to things all the time.
Well, I mean, in some ways, when I say you tell me, it's a facile response, but it's also actually a genuine response, right? And what I would imagine is that it's not, it's irrelevant. There's no response. There's no single response that's the response to this material. I've had people get up and walk out. I've had people get titillated. I've had all kinds of reactions. That tells that person about themselves. It doesn't tell them anything about me or me about them.
I think that's what I'm wondering. I'm wondering about the telling something about yourself. Like, that seems to me the really important thing at the moment. And I wonder, I guess I wondered about techniques for providing a conducive context for people to engage, or, you know, yeah, engage with their reaction. Because I don't think people necessarily will, just because they have a reaction. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
It's perhaps the in the context of an avant-garde literary performance or avant-garde poetry performance, the knowledgeable audience member is continually doing what you describe as a meditator, reacting but then suspending the reaction, reacting, suspending the reaction, and that's perhaps part of the process that we embrace in a context like the present one.
Did you manage to get your reaction to work?
I think I did. Yes? Since we're obviously discussing reaction here, I found myself at one point, I was almost, in lack of a better word, obliged to separate myself from it. I couldn't no longer try to visualize and try to identify with the persons or put myself in their situations, because it was just too much information, or and it came so quickly without leaving any space for self-reflection, and it created a very strong emotional reaction because it was highly unpleasant. And I'm not going to compare the thing I'm going to play in any further way than the fact that I had the same reaction, although it's about the same subject, although the point of view in which the actions are presented are from just a completely different point of view, although I had the same reaction to the same content. It's a song by the hip-hop group called UGK. It's a song called Steal Your Mind, and it's also featuring rapper Snoop Dogg and Too Short. If we could play that.
Can I ask how long it is?
It's four minutes.
Is everybody okay to listen to a 4-minute song, or do we want to just listen to an excerpt of it?
We could have one verse and a chorus.
Okay, yeah, whatever you think.
Yeah.
Okay, Kenny?
Say player, hey man, it's PMC man. Your bitch just got peeled, man. I got your hoe, man. Look here, man. If you won't give me the bitch clothes, then we gon' have to go to war around this bitch. Hold up, church, you chose. Never gon' give a pay eye to the game. To the cold, real crimp, never lame. Nigga say I'm not a real man. What he to the pimp, bro, I don't hit you niggas crazy. He comes country with his face and his mind. He from this red. ready to show from the CD in the cover, in the line about the whole fucking on top of the cover. I stole your bitch, but you're not a good guy. Can't control my body if you can't control a mind. I pull the line from the man. If you lose all your bitches, you can hold up on the bag. Hold your bag, hold your bag, hold your bag.
And so what was it about the experience here and that you saw some kind of connection, or how did you?
The connection was that the song is about controlling a prostitute's mind. Like, it's not enough to like have a physical control over them. You have to actually make them psychologically dependent on you. And I found out it was when I heard the text, I was really surprised that it is released under a record label. It's from a major record label. I was shook up when I heard that, and I just had the same reaction to or the same emotional reaction, and it just made me think about the next you perform, although I will say it's slightly more refined in many ways.
Which one?
yours. Which is my initial reaction to.
Martin, there's a question here.
The question was, would you consider yourself a feminist?
Sure.
There's another question here.
I guess in light of having heard the music, I think this sort of actually just reaffirmed what I was going to say, but I think it was a really interesting point that you made about the performance really being us just in capturing a material, that it is you delivering this performance, but it's also just encountering something that's been recontextualized. In a lot of ways, it's acting the same way that an excerpt of music or a newspaper clip or something on the television or driving down the street or any of those things that you are just encountering and reacting and these things. And I guess my question for you was, as the performer, you are sort of removing yourself from that process. And I think that's sort of what makes seeing the performance sort of interesting and more difficult to see that process in that you sort of take this more authoritative stance because you are the television screen, you are the record company, you are, and you become this physical regurgitation. But we still see that you're human, and I guess just I would like to hear a little bit about what it feels like to be in that position.
But of course I won't answer that. Because what's interesting to me is I'm performing a function. I'm essentially an apparatus, and I'm an apparatus on multiple levels. I'm an apparatus in a legal sense, very overtly, but I'm also an apparatus in this context. I am the television. I am the, in the paper that I did not give to you, but you heard, I was the apparatus that gives a paper in this context. The point is, like the television, it doesn't matter what the television feels. It doesn't matter what, does the record company think prostitution is bad or good? We don't ask the record company. We don't ask the record company, not, and I don't mean this in a way of like, well, we should interrogate the record company or any of that. I think the point is that it comes back to you. What songs are on your thing? What music? What is the context that you provide? That's my goal, is to instantiate that moment. There's a reason I wear a suit, right? It's part of the apparatus.